From NPR News, you're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered, a podcast that gathers the weekend's very best stories and features from All Things Considered. I'm Rachel Martin, in for Guy Raz. In this episode of the podcast, we take a look back on the destructive weather that's ravaged the Midwest. Also, the dark side of stuntmaster Evel Knievel, and Brad Pitt stops by to talk about his ambitious film, The Tree of Life. Plus, the best burger tricks and tips from the guys at The Sporkful, including barbecuing eggs, and the life of a U.S. Marine Band trumpet player. That's on this episode of The Best of Weekends on All Things Considered.
You have shown the world what it means to love thy neighbor. You've banded together. You've come to each other's aid. You've demonstrated a simple truth, that amid heartbreak and tragedy, no one is a stranger.
President Obama, on a visit to Joplin, Missouri, that marks the end of a week of devastating weather across the Midwest. That's our cover story today. It started in Joplin a week ago this evening. Former Mayor Gary Shaw described the scene the next morning.
Pickups stacked on top of one another. The trees and everything that had uprooted, it just stripped the bark off of them. I mean, they're like somebody's taken a knife and cut all the bark off of them. We've lost tons and tons of homes. And there are people out trying to uncover the dead right now.
Days later, another round of storms struck Oklahoma, where Governor Mary Fallon spoke with residents trying to salvage what they could.
You left when you heard the storm was coming?
Yeah.
Went to a safer place?
Yep.
Did you lose everything, or you been able to find some things?
Found a bunch of stuff. All the furniture was gone.
Meanwhile, residents in Alabama are still recovering from tornadoes that hit there late last month. Jerry Moore and his family rode those storms out in an old school bus he had buried in a hillside.
Well, when we come out, we thought everything was gone because we couldn't see nothing. There were so many trees down. We seen there was the top of one of my daughter's trailers in the lake, but I thought it was the house to start with. It's just something that you don't believe, you know. It just looked like everything was gone. And finally, after we looked around, we realized what had happened.
We turn now to NPR's Wade Goodwin, who is in Joplin, just outside the memorial service where President Obama spoke. Hi, Wade. Thanks for talking with us.
Good afternoon, Rachel.
So, Wade, Air Force One flew over the tornado's path before the president actually landed in Joplin. And then I understand his motorcade stopped in the most devastated part of the city?
Yeah, he talked to a family who was helping sift through the remains of their uncle's house, found out that the uncle had made it out alive and expressed his satisfaction at that. And he referenced his trip to Tuscaloosa, Alabama last month and said that what he saw around him today was just as heartbreaking and, he said, even more devastating.
Joplin is obviously a very wounded city at this point. What was the president's message today to the community?
Well, I think, you know, it was twofold. He wanted to remind everybody that the federal government and the American people and he himself were with them, and that they were not going to be abandoned by the federal government and the American people. But he also talked about the admiration that the country had for the people of Joplin, for their courage and perseverance. He told stories of heroes, of a Pizza Hut manager, who tied a rope around his arm and put 12 people in a freezer and held that door shut until he was sucked out by the tornado. He was killed, but he saved a dozen people. And there was just a story after story of people who gave their lives to save others.
The tornado hit a week ago today. Wade, as you have had conversations and have gotten around and gotten a sense of the city, how is Joplin dealing with the cleanup at this point?
Well, it's just overwhelming. I mean, the cleanup's going to go on for a year at least. Thousands of people came to see the president. They brought signs that said, God loves Joplin. That's a little bit of a response to Westboro Baptist, who was here celebrating the death of those who were killed in the tornado as just punishment for an evil country. That rankled, as you can imagine, but they were out here to say that's not true, that God loves Joplin, and they love Joplin too.
NPR's Wade Goodwin with the president in Joplin, Missouri. Thanks very much, Wade.
It's my pleasure.
Storm chasers Jeff and Catherine Petrosky have been to most of the places hit by this year's record-breaking tornado season. We reached the couple on the phone this past Friday. They were on the road, on their way to Oklahoma City, chasing yet another storm. They captured some of the first video of the Joplin tornado.
I got it.
Stay with it. Stay with it, Kevin. Going right down toward it.
Oh, crap.
I know.
Why are you doing that?
We were heading westbound just out of downtown Joplin.
There he is. Tornado's coming in the city.
So about that time, I saw a policeman ahead of me.
Hey, guys.
I pulled up beside him, and he rolled out his window.
The tornado's trying to come down right here. The winds are on the north, and it's coming back around. The tornado's right here. It's coming on the ground right here.
You know, I pointed down south, and at that point, I said, please reach down the siren. Be very large and powerful tornado.
Hey, get the sirens going. Get the sirens going. I'm telling you.
About 20 or 30 seconds went by. I heard the sirens go back off again as I'm driving. I made a U-turn. You know, sliding debris coming by us. And the farther we go east on Tornado Street, I'm thinking I can get ahead of tornado, but the tornado is actually expanding and consuming us.
I am.
The winds are screaming outside. And I know I have to stop, so I pull over to the side. I turn the back of the truck toward the wind so that I'm not sideways to the wind and get picked up. The core of the tornado is passing just south and east of me, a couple hundred yards. As soon as the tornado passes, everything behind the tornado is flat.
And it's a massive tornado, massive destruction. It's a mile wide tornado.
Jeff Petrosky's been doing this for 3 decades. Catherine says it's only been 14 years for her, but this year seems different.
I'm seeing more wedge tornadoes. They immediately drop down from the sky, and then rapidly intensify to within a mile wide in a matter of minutes. And this is what's unusual. Jeff could probably give you...
Sure. Can we get Jeff back on the line?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay.
Hi, Jeff. You want to add to that what you're seeing differently this season?
Well, this year, a good example, yesterday morning, it was 50 degrees here in northeast Oklahoma, and today in southwest Oklahoma right now, it's 106 degrees. So when you have these boundaries, this cold front and warm fronts moving back and forth over a 2- or 3-state region, you're setting a lethal condition up for explosive thunderstorm development with extreme wind shear.
There is the obvious question, and Jeff and Catherine get it all the time, why they do this. In the off-season, Jeff makes forecasting software. He and Catherine also sell their storm footage to media outlets. And when they're chasing storms, they're in constant contact with local authorities and news organizations. Jeff is the first to admit running toward a tornado is something you can't experience through a video.
To be able to make a forecast and be able to look at a map, look at the data, pick a town, pick a target, get to that location, and then watch the sky change before you, so that you've got experience to understand.
Jeff Petrosky, he and his wife Catherine spoke to us from their car on the way to Oklahoma City. While storms rage through the Midwest, farther south, huge swaths of land are still covered by floodwaters from the Mississippi River. But many areas were saved by something called HESCO baskets. These are essentially enormous, rectangular, stackable sandbags, easy to transport, quick to fill. And these baskets are also used to protect U.S. military outposts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN has the story.
HESCO baskets don't appear high-tech. They look like wire trash cans lined with fabric. They come in 15-foot-long sections that collapse down to 4 inches tall. One 18-wheeler can haul in a mile of flood protection. Pop them up, fill them with sand, and 2 men can do the equivalent of 1,500 sandbags in 20 minutes. National Guard crews have been working round the clock, says Sergeant Tedrick Burton.
We have gotten these down pretty well. It's almost second nature with these.
In South Louisiana, HESCO baskets stretch for miles along low-lying roads, around schools, and atop existing levees.
It's much easier and quicker.
Duval Arthur is the emergency preparedness director for St. Mary Parish.
You can cover so much more territory with these. You clip them together, and you fill them with sand, and you're through with it.
Some of the HESCOs are being reused from Hurricane Katrina. That recycling helps make them cheaper than sandbags. The Corps of Engineers found the baskets cost as much as $5,000 less per 1,000 feet.
I've gotten a call from a couple of people telling me that you were going to be down here inspecting our levees.
Yes, sir.
Dennis Barkemeyer is HESCO's senior technical representative. He's been in the field since January, following floodwaters from Canada all the way to Amelia, Louisiana. With an estimated 10 miles of wire baskets in this parish alone, Barkemeyer uses a golf cart to drive along them.
So this came from the local country club.
Quite the ride here.
You know, I don't mind walking a few miles, but, you know, this being month five of flood fighting, it's nice to have a little help from the golf course.
National Guard troops are accustomed to the technology. Many have used HESCO baskets in Iraq and Afghanistan, where they fortify forward operating bases. But when holding back water, Barkemeyer says attention to detail is critical.
If we are 99% successful here, we lose. So unless you're perfect on your efforts, it's a non-success.
So far, the HESCO baskets have impressed emergency officials. In Vidalia, Louisiana, a pyramid of HESCOs withstood 8 feet of the swollen Mississippi River. Now that they've got their hands on some, emergency officials like Duval Arthur don't want to give them up.
I know the Corps bought them. I'm sure they're going to want them back, but we're hoping we can keep some of them to help us in the future.
Arthur says he'd be happy to fold up the HESCOs for another rainy day. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Amelia, Louisiana.
Just a few hundred miles west of the Mississippi, in parts of Texas, rainy days are in short supply. So short that Governor Rick Perry issued a proclamation last month asking Texans to pray for rain. So far, that hasn't worked, and the drought's taking a toll on farmers like Kurt Mowry. He grows grain sorghum, soybeans, and corn on his farm near Rocheron, 50 miles south of Houston.
It's extremely tough. Most normal months, we should get 3 to 5 inches of rain. We've missed out on that, and we've had anywhere from half inch to zero rainfall for the past 3 months. My dad has always talked about the drought of the 50s that we had in Texas, and generally these droughts of these magnitudes usually run in about 50, 60-year cycles. So are we fixing to run into our drought cycle here in Texas like we did back in the 50s?
That's tough to get your head around, especially when land is being flooded out next door in Louisiana.
It seems kind of odd that, you know, they're suffering the opposite end of the spectrum that I am with too much water.
That's farmer Kurt Mowry in Rocheron, Texas. September 8, 1974, was a momentous day in American history. Sure, that was the day that Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon. But did you know that was also the day Evel Knievel tried to jump across the Snake River Canyon on a jet-powered motorcycle? Now, Knievel didn't make it across. His parachute popped open too early and sent him nose first down into the canyon.
Well, there's been a mistake. He looks like he's going into the canyon.
Evel Knievel walked away from the Snake River Canyon relatively unscathed. In fact, he survived all his daredevil stunts. When he died in 2007 at the age of 69, it was lung disease that killed him. Sports writer Lee Montville has written a new biography. It's called Evel, The High-Flying Life of Evel Knievel, American Showman, Daredevil, and Legend. And Lee Montville joins me now from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Welcome to the program, Lee.
Glad to be here.
So Evel Knievel is almost a semi-mythical figure by this point, kind of like Johnny Appleseed or Paul Bunyan. But in the 1970s, he was everywhere, larger than life. Just describe to us, how big was he at that point?
It was a different time back then. Those of us who are old enough to remember it all. You know, Mom and Dad and the kids, they sat around the television and they had the three choices. And Evel kind of popped up in the middle of it all with this replay of himself crashing and bouncing and looking like a rag doll trying to jump over the fountains at Caesar's Palace. And it was kind of riveting. People just started paying attention to him, and he became sort of a sequential reality show. You paid attention to his life, and that was before reality shows. It was before the X Games, before all these extreme daredevil sports.
Let's rewind a little bit. You start the book in Butte, Montana. This is where Evel was born and raised. And I happen to be from that part of the world, Idaho, but still in the neighborhood of Montana. And I know Butte to be a pretty mellow Western American town, but You describe it very differently back then. Explain what Butte was.
No, it really never was a mild, mellow Western town. It was an immigrant town of young men who were drawn there by the richest copper mine in the world. And so the entertainments that developed were for those guys, which were wine, women, and song all the time, and gambling thrown in on the side. It was as wild as you could get in the United States of America.
And this is where a young Robert Knievel was coming of age. And it was supposedly a Butte cop, a police officer, who ended up giving him his famous nickname. Can you tell us that story?
Robert Knievel, his parents split up when he was 2 years old, and so he was basically raised on the streets of Butte, and he became your basic bad actor. He robbed places and did all kinds of larcenous things and wound up in jail, not for long stretches of time, but overnight, and he was in the jail one night. In the story, it might be apocryphal, but there was another guy in Butte who was a true bad actor called William Knievel. Knievel supposedly was in the jail at the same time as Knievel, and the jailer said, "Hey, look, we've got an awful Knievel and we've got an evil Knievel. What a place." And the name never stuck in Butte, but when he got into the daredevil business, he was looking for something a little flashier than Bob. And settle for evil.
But interestingly enough, he doesn't want evil to be spelled E-V-I-L because he thinks that sounds bad or dark. He had this bad rap, but there was part of him that wanted to not be the bad guy.
Oh, yeah, there was a large part of that. You know, I mean, he was setting himself up as sort of a Captain America. You know, it was the 60s and the 70s, and there was an absence of heroes in America, and he was glad to volunteer to be the hero.
So he obviously had a sense that there was an appetite for this publicly, this kind of drama. People wanted to watch someone risk their life in this way. And he thought, sure, I can be that guy.
Oh, yeah. You know, we all love to sit at that dangerous intersection and wonder what's going to happen next. And that's what he sold. It's amazing. There was no real moral or ethical debate about what he was doing. It was like, this is something that's going on, and let's all watch. Bring the kids and sit down and have a great day.
One of the threads that really runs through your book, and it happens again and again, is that people meet Evil Knievel, work with him, get robbed by him, and they decide, this is just not a good person. I don't want to be associated with this guy. And they walk away.
A guy said to me once, he said, if Evil Knievel likes you, he would do anything for you. But if he doesn't like you, he'll do anything to you. And that little preposition difference was sort of a foundation of his life, and especially in business dealings. He was a tough guy, and he had a strange relationship with money. You know, he would steal it if he didn't have it, and if he had it, he would just blow it on anything, you know, fast cars.
Women?
Women, oh, yeah. I mean, he boasted that he had relations with over 2,000 women. All the time, being married and the father of three and then four.
What do you like about Evil Knievel? Is there anything redeeming about him?
The one thing that I think he appealed to people in was that I think all of us have a little bit of daredevil to us, you know? He was a guy that just, you run with that stick and you'll poke your eye out. You know, he'd run with the stick all day long. And there's something freeing in seeing someone kind of unafraid of stuff. You know, I mean, that's what all these X Games guys do now, and they flip around Shaun White and Tony Hawk, and you go, wow, how do they even do that? Mm-hmm. And he was the start of all that. And following his dream, you know, he had that 15-year-old adolescent male dream of being rich and famous and having a wonderful time, but he was ruthless in going to achieve it. And It's a testament to how badly you can want something, and he wanted it badly enough that he would put his life on the line.
Lee Montville is the author of Evil, The High-Flying Life of Evil Knievel, American Showman, Daredevil, and Legend. Lee, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
There's a new Brad Pitt movie in theaters this weekend, but it's not like any Brad Pitt movie you've seen before. It's called The Tree of Life. It just won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival, and in it, Pitt plays a husband and father who, along with his wife, is raising three boys in 1950s Texas. In the movie, Pitt's character is strict and emotionally distant. He expresses love for his sons openly, but he's got a short temper, and that can be downright frightening at times. At one point, he tries to teach his boys how to fight.
Come on, hit me. Come on. Come on, Jack. Hit me. Hit me. Hit me. Come on. Come on. Hit. Here it is. Here it is. Hit. Come on, son. Come on. Son, left.
The family's story is at the center of the film, but director Terrence Malick is reaching for a lot more here. Universal questions about nature, science, philosophy, and religion. And Pitt says his character, too, is asking universal questions.
You know, the family lives in the era of the 50s, and what I understand, coming from a not a rural area, but at least certainly more southern in its roots, a father's knows best kind of mentality. And the character here in The Tree of Life is someone who feels most oppressed by the world, oppressed by the job. The American dream didn't work out as he believed it would be, quite envious and bitter that people are ahead of him. Naturally, when someone feels oppressed, they find someone weaker to pass that oppression on. And the sadness in this situation, it's on his sons. But here in this moment, he's trying to prepare them for the world as he understands it, and that is that it's a fight, and you're on your own, and you got to take care of yourself.
When you explained this movie to your kids, how did you explain it?
I haven't even explained what we do for a living to my kids.
Seriously?
Well, they know Mom and Dad, you know, they tell stories, they're in movies. And it's an everyday thing, and it's nothing more than that.
What was the hardest part about making this?
I wouldn't say hard. It was just completely different. You have to understand a movie set is very chaotic. There's hundreds of people. There's generators and trucks. And this was a completely different experience. We had none of that. He rented the neighborhood, this neighborhood that had been cut off by the interstate in the 50s and was ostensibly a time capsule for that era. There were no lights, camera lights, or no generators, and the camera was all handheld. So it was a very a kind of freeform, low-key experience.
You mentioned the fact that you were raised in a fairly rural environment in the Midwest. This takes place in 1950s rural Texas, small-town Texas. Was there anything about that environment, that part of the film, that resonated with you personally?
I had great parallels with this upbringing in sense of environment, staying out late till the sun went down, hearing your mom's voice call you in, getting into the trouble, breaking windows, firecrackers, playing in cemeteries. You know, I could feel the bomb in the air on the summer nights, and yes, it's very close to me, so I was quite comfortable.
I want to ask you a little more about the experience of working with Terrence Malick. He is a bit of an anomaly in Hollywood. He's made only five movies in the period of nearly 40 years. A very private man, and he doesn't do press, doesn't do a lot of interviews like this one. And his movies are not exactly the kind of pictures that studios line up to fund. Can you talk a little bit about what was particularly different about working with Terrence Malick?
Terry is all freeform. He's someone who's looking for moments of truth and not created moments of truth, the accidents that happen. So he'll torpedo a scene. By that, I mean he'll push the cameraman beforehand, or he'll, if Jessica and I were having a fight in the first take, he would suddenly send the youngest child in to sit down at the table and would change the whole tenor of the scene. He would throw a dog up in the front seat and laugh. He would just, he's just constantly trying to push people off their comfort zones.
How much time did you spend with the kids, the young actors who are on the film?
Well, we practically
preparing
live together
roles
every day.
Oh, you live together?
No, I mean, not literally. We didn't go home together. But, you know, we spent the days together like a family would, playing between takes, playing outside, throwing the ball around. By the way, Terry Malick is a fantastic athlete. As humble and meek as the man seems, he's quite aggressive. He had a ball in his hand.
I want to switch gears a little bit. You've been very involved in the field of architecture. It's something that you're interested in, and you've extended that in your work in Louisiana. There are some interesting parallels between what happened in New Orleans in 2005 in the Hurricane Katrina and this film, The Tree of Life. There's a message in that film that life is finite and can change in an instant. And clearly, Hurricane Katrina changed everything for millions of people. Wondering if you can talk a little bit about your experience working in the Gulf. I've actually seen some of those houses that your foundation has been building in the Lower Ninth Ward. And I'm curious to hear from you, 4 years into this, do you think it's having the kind of catalytic effect that you had hoped for?
Well, first I'll say that the film does speak to our impermanence. And I think whenever we see these catastrophic events, it again reminds us of our impermanence and fragility. And just like the tornado just hit Joplin, Missouri. So I also draw the parallels there. The project itself has been more successful than I possibly imagined. These homes that have been built are being built for the same price to build an antiquated, non-efficient house where your bills are $300, and here we're seeing families with $30, $20 a month, and so it frees up all this income, extra income for the family. But the real interesting thing, the thing I did not expect, was the feeling in the neighborhood, the feeling within the families, just the what it meant for them for, in a place where they're used to being marginalized, for someone to come along and help them out. Just that has changed, seemed to change their life view. And I have to believe that's being passed on.
You've said in other interviews about this film that you wanted this particular movie to start a discussion, to get people to ask big questions. And I wonder what kind of discussion that this film and making it may have provoked in your own life.
During my last viewing of the film, it occurred to me, well, let me back up by saying there's been a lot of theological discussions attached with this film, as I understand it, and, mm-hmm. And spiritual conversations.
There are a lot of religious allegories. There are a lot of questions about, is there a God?
Yeah, and iconography, and sure. And first, what I'll say about what I know about Terry is a man who sees God in science and science in God, and usually these things are opposing forces. But me, for myself, it speaks to the unknown, the things that we cannot define, that it seems to me we try to comfort ourselves with stories that stem from theology or different religions, and that maybe the real peace to be found is in the acceptance of the unknowing, that we don't know, but that there is something, that there's a real power there that's greater than us, and maybe that's enough.
That's Brad Pitt. He stars in the new film, The Tree of Life, which opens in select cities this weekend. Brad, thanks for being here.
All right, thanks much.
There aren't too many guys who love talking about food more than Dan Pashman and Mark Garrison. The two run a wildly popular blog and podcast called The Sporkful. And in honor of Memorial Day weekend, we've asked them to share the secret to the perfect hamburger. Dan and Mark are in our New York bureau. Hey, guys.
Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
So for people who haven't heard of The Sporkful, just to clarify, you two are not chefs, right? You're essentially professional foodies.
We don't accept the moniker foodie. In fact, that term implies a certain amount of pretension and expertise. And we like to appeal more to the universal audience, which is eaters, because we all eat and we all enjoy eating.
So, you two, what do you think about when you're setting out to construct that quintessential American cuisine, the perfect burger?
Well, start with the meat. So you really just need good meat, 20 to 25% fat content.
I actually disagree with Mark's fat ratio statement there. But, you know, Rachel, for me to really illustrate what I'm talking about, I kind of feel like we got to get out of this studio and actually find ourselves a grill. Mark and I used to work at NPR. I know the studio pretty well. I think that there's a wormhole in here somewhere. Mark and I can transport ourselves. Hang on. Mark, stay close by because this is going to be intense.
What's going
on? Right, where is it? It's right about
Yeah.
here. All right, Rachel, we've cracked open some beers. We have lit the grill. We're going to throw some burgers on.
Wait, this is so unfair. So I'm still in a studio in Washington, but you guys found a grill? Where are you?
We have transported ourselves to a grill in a backyard in Brooklyn. You may even hear some sirens in the background. And we'll grill a burger for you, even though you're not going to get to eat it.
Okay, sounds good. So we're constructing the perfect burger. And you were talking about the meat-to-fat ratio? What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, you don't want a burger that's going to be too lean, because remember that when you heat fat, the flames from the grill will leap up and they will kiss and smooch and embrace your meat, and you want that to happen to a point. But if your meat has too much fat, the flames will become too aggressive in their smooching, and your meat will end up dry.
So what kind of meat are you guys using today?
Mark said 75 to 80%. I'd say 82.5 is your sweet spot. So if you get half 80 and half 85 and mix it, that's a home run.
But I think one thing about Dan, you know, he's talking about percentages. These are good things to think about. But if you don't want to deal with that, go to your butcher, ask them for their favorite mix, because they'll have, you know, different concoctions. How much chuck do they use? How much skirt steak do they use? Various things that you can put in there. So we're talking about beef, and that's what we have going here.
So you guys are actually...
Hey, Rachel, I got to interrupt for a second. I think we got to flip the burgers. Hang on one sec.
Yeah, we're yakking, but we don't want to burn these guys. And the key is to flip it just once, because every flip can lose juice, and you want to sear that flavor in there and keep it going.
So I'm a big cheese fan, so I kind of like any kind of cheese on my burger. How do you guys feel about cheese and other high-profile, more luxury toppings, shall we say?
Well, I think you certainly can have a lot of fun with more elaborate cheeses. I love smoked Gouda. I've been meaning to experiment by taking some ricotta cheese and mixing pesto in it and spreading that on a burger, because that could be very exciting. But there's also absolutely nothing wrong with good old-fashioned American cheese. And what I do, Rachel, is I melt the cheese on top of the burger on the grill. Then when I remove it from the grill, I put the bottom bun on top of the cheese, flip the burger, and put the top bun on what was the bottom. That points the cheese tongueward and therefore accentuates cheesy goodness.
So, you know, it's Memorial Day weekend. It's a special weekend, long weekend. What if I really want to up my game? Can you give me two or three maybe surprising toppings that I can put on this burger to really, you know, shake people up a little bit?
I'll throw you a couple surprises that you can also do on the grill. And this also can help your vegetarian friends who maybe do not want to have these great burgers that we're making like that. One thing that I learned when I was in Argentina is if you take a big, like thick, like 3/4-inch slab of provolone cheese, put some olive oil, oregano, and some red pepper flakes on that and put that on the grill, you can melt that. And that's like a wonderful appetizer before, because you get like all the smoky flavor of the grill. The other thing you can do, and this is kind of a nice party trick if you want to, you know, show someone something they haven't seen before, tell them you're going to barbecue an egg. Take
No.
a bell pepper, cut it in half, then crack the egg into it, throw all that on the grill. Not only do you get like a delicious over-medium kind of egg that has all the great flavors of the coals and the smoke, but then you also have it served inside a grilled bell pepper, which is also pretty awesome.
You know, I love that idea, and it opens up a whole realm of breakfast barbecuing, breakfast grilling.
No, the grill can be used 24 hours a day. Like, we don't have to wait until the afternoon or anything like that. Like, you can have wonderful things on the grill anytime you like.
Yeah, let's keep in mind that man subsisted for quite a long time cooking with nothing but open flames.
Okay, so you guys are getting your burgers off the grill right now.
Yeah, these guys are coming off the grill. We've got nice grill marks on both sides, looking good.
Nice.
We did go with the sesame toasted bun this time.
Good call.
All right, we're digging in, Rachel.
Okay.
Pardon us while we take a bite.
You're about to take a bite of the finished product. How's it taste?
Very nice.
It's juicy.
It's good. Dan Pashman and Mark Garrison, they're the guys behind the Sportful podcast and blog, which you can check out at sportful.com. Thanks a lot, guys.
Have a good weekend, Rachel.
Bye. Thank you.
When Jeffrey Strong graduated from Northwestern University with a degree in music performance, he thought he'd get a job playing the trumpet in a big city orchestra like most of his friends. Instead, he ended up cutting his hair, putting on a uniform, and joining the President's Own, the oldest professional music group in the country, the United States Marine Band.
I started playing the trumpet in sixth grade. Every year in the holiday season, my dad would play Miles Davis CDs, so the trumpet was always in my ear. For a lot of high school kids, Friday nights might have been going out and getting into trouble or whatever. And we would usually go to someone's house and play music from 5 or 6 o'clock until 2 or 3 in the morning. I knew about the Marine Band when I was younger. I remember actually talking about it with my friends when I was in high school and saying, gosh, you know, the band sounds great. Could you imagine getting in there someday? But that also seemed like it would be impossible. There were 110 trumpet players for the audition I took. I remember my first rehearsal with the band when we started off with a march, and I got this big grin on my face, and I had to stop playing because I was so taken aback by how cool it was. One of the first things you'll notice when you come to one of our concerts are our bright red coats. And that's a tradition that goes back to when we were on the battlefield so that we could be seen and told what call to play to give directions to the troops. My first time playing for the president was actually for the Easter egg roll. And we were sitting up on the balcony, and then the double doors up there open up, and out steps the president. And it was really awesome. We do a lot of stuff at the White House. We have upwards of 300 events that we will do at the White House every year. And we really have to be able to provide music for whatever the president wants. One of the other trumpet players in the band said to me when I first got here that we're like the president's iPod, whatever he needs. So when George Bush was in office, we put together a country band. And when there are holiday receptions, we have a chamber orchestra that goes over and plays holiday tunes and waltzes and people dance. One of the most important things for me is playing taps in funerals. I've had a lot of friends who have done service overseas, and I've lost some very close friends. And so for me, the opportunity to provide that service was something very important. When you play taps to honor the person who gave their life, it could be a retired lieutenant colonel, or it could be someone who was recently killed in action. It could be daunting. But no matter how nervous I am, I'm always able to calm my mind and calm myself down. And I think it's because of how important that moment really is. It may be simple, but it's still a very powerful and beautiful piece.
Staff Sergeant Jeffrey Strong, trumpeter with the United States Marine Band. On yesterday's show, we heard from Major General John Campbell, just home from leading U.S. forces in eastern Afghanistan. He was in Washington to take part in several Memorial Day events. Campbell told us of his own tribute. Every day, on the battlefield and off, he carries with him a set of 3x5 index cards, each with a name, photo, and story about a soldier who died under his command.
You know, I carry those around so I never forget their sacrifice, never forget the sacrifice of their families. I spent all day at Walter Reed talking to wounded warriors, making sure they understood that, you know, we want them to get better. They're working very hard to get better. It was very, very uplifting to talk to all of them. And I pulled out those cards and we talked about some of their buddies that, you know, that didn't make it back. And, you know, they want to honor their lives. They want to make sure they did not die in vain. And every one of those has been very, very tough. Every one of those has been very tragic. Every one of those has changed the lives of many, many people around each of those fallen heroes. I'm so very, very proud to have the opportunity to serve with young men and women who, you know, volunteer to put themselves in harm's way. And over this Memorial Day, we can never, ever forget their sacrifice. We can never, ever forget the sacrifice of the families that have paid the ultimate sacrifice here. And it was just my honor to serve with many of them in Afghanistan.
U.S. Army Major General John Campbell. Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Brent Bachman and produced by Phil Harrell, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Megan Kane, Grant Clark, Chris Benderev, and Jessica Deal. Daniel Shukin is our technical director. Rick Holter is our senior editor, and our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Rachel Martin. We're back next Sunday with the best of Weekends on All Things Considered. And remember, you can hear the full version of the program on your local public radio station each Saturday and Sunday afternoon.